This is Winning with Wellness, a podcast about inspiring the wellness warrior in you. If you're feeling lost or alone in your wellness journey, or are looking for new ideas and inspiration, you are in the right place. A place you can learn about all things wellness in business, life, and living. Your host, Jenny Rice, will be bringing you inspiring stories and practical tools to improve your overall wellness, personally and professionally. Imagine what living a life of wellness would be like. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Winning with Wellness. Thrilled you're here to inspire the wellness warrior in you. I am so excited to dig into this episode and have this amazing conversation. You guys, we've got Candace here with us, and she is exceptional in her field. Candace, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jenny. Hi, everyone.
This is going to be a great, there's no doubt in my mind we're going to come across some interesting things that are going to resonate with a lot of people in different ways because of the field that you're in. And what I want to do is share with everybody, Candace, a little bit about your background, and then we can dig into it, if that sounds okay with you.
Sure, that's fine.
Great.
Well, just to kind of nutshell it, when I was about 23, which was quite a long time ago, I suddenly became very ill, and I had no idea what was happening to me. I had gone for lunch, and shortly after lunch, I started having symptoms that were like food poisoning, and that's what I thought I had, except it never went away. And it turned out, after many years of being misdiagnosed, because what I had was Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory bowel disease for people who don't know. But it was the new disease on the block, and none of the doctors knew what it was. They didn't know what to do for me. They thought it was all in my head. It was awful for a number of years, and had to have a number of surgeries and things like that. I'm a lot better now because I've learned how to take care of myself, but it's one of those incurable diseases. So I still have it. But what the doctors did, because they didn't know what else to do, is they threw a lot of addictive medications at me, including opioids like codeine and OxyContin and just a whole bunch of those kinds of morphine, those kinds of drugs, as well as Valium, the benzodiazepines. And, you know, I was a good girl at the time, and I'm not so much anymore, but I was then. And I took the medications. I just did. And they helped me feel better. I smoked a lot of pot because that helped me feel better. And I didn't understand that I had become addicted to these medications, because addiction wasn't on the radar at that point. Didn't even occur to me now. But all of those substances are depressants in the system, in the human system. So if you fast forward about 15 years, I was so depressed that I became suicidal and needed some help around that. Instead of taking my life, which I thought about a lot, I reached out for help. And that's why I'm here today, and I'm very grateful. But so in 1987, I finally heard about addiction. I started going to some 12-step programs, and I started my recovery. So today, well, let's say in July of this year, I will have 35 years clean and sober.
That's incredible.
So thank you. And when I was about 3 years clean, I made the decision that I wanted to work in the addiction field. I wanted to give back, because I had gotten so much help. So I started working in Vancouver's downtown east side. And for people who don't know where that is, Vancouver, Canada, where I live, the downtown east side is the lowest income area of our country, of our huge country. And So many of the people who have addiction, drug, alcohol, mental health issues, homelessness, people are there in the downtown east side. That's kind of who live there. And so I got a job as an addiction counselor in 1991 and was there for 16 years, which is a long time to work there. But I loved it. I loved the work. And what happened while I was working there and seeing the people who were addicted, I started getting phone calls from their loved ones. And I don't know how that happened because I didn't go out trying to find them. They found me. And they basically said, "We're at the end of our rope. We don't know what to do." You know, and so I had them come in for sessions, heard their stories. There were so many similarities and most of what I would call mistakes, loving mistakes, but mistakes that they were making had to do with enabling. They were giving money to an addict. They were letting them stay in their homes rent free and be abusive and obnoxious, and things like that were happening. And so, I mean, I didn't really know what to do with them, but I started working with them and found that I loved working with them. And as we got past the point of enabling, the addicts started to change. Mm-hmm. They kind of take notice when the loved one starts doing something different. The addicts take notice and they kind of go, "Uh-oh, this isn't working for me anymore. You know, I better make some different decisions." With almost every family I work with, that's what happens.
That's powerful.
So I've been working as an addiction therapist, specializing in working with the families of people who are struggling with addiction, because there's so little help out there. There's a little bit, but you know, most of it is 12-step based, and that doesn't work for everybody, and that's not what I do. So there was a huge gap in service that I could see, and just decided this is what I'm going to do. So then I wrote a book that won some awards. It's called Loving an Addict, Loving Yourself, mm-hmm. The Top 10 Survival Tips for Loving Someone with an Addiction. And yeah, won USA and international book awards. It's used in rehab centers in North America. And, you know, it's apparently a really good book and helpful to people. And it still surprises me even after all these years, because when I was in my addiction, I never thought I'd ever do anything that helped the world, you know, and here I am. So people can actually change, and I'm living proof of that. So that's kind of how it all got started.
When you bring up a really profound point, is you didn't start out with the intention of becoming an addict, right? Like most people don't wake up and go, "This is my goal, life's goal. I can't wait to become an addict to mess up you know, my life."
Let's sign up for Addiction 101. That
right.
Would be fun.
Right. So
no, I don't believe that anybody does that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's probably people listening right now that might be questioning their own situation, because again, yours was brought on through you were under somebody's care. You were in care and it wasn't being monitored appropriately, or maybe they're seeing some signs. Like what would you recommend to people that are listening that questioning that they may have somebody that they love or that they care for or they're friends with that are showing signs of addiction? How can they help them? What's the best practices in that?
Well, I mean, that's such a great question. I want to go back to what you said a minute ago, because even though people don't choose to become addicts, I do believe that staying in addiction is a choice.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether you think it's a disease or you think it's this or that. Underneath all of that, you make a choice. You either stay in addiction or you get into some kind of recovery. And any of us who are in recovery know that.
Right.
So it's absolutely a choice. And I think when loved ones understand that, because there are programs out there, 12-step programs talk about, you know, how this is a disease, you're powerless over the disease, relapse is a normal and natural part of it. Once an addict, always an addict. I don't see that. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a disease. I have Crohn's disease. I can't just say, oh, I'm not going to have Crohn's anymore. I wish I could. It doesn't work that way. And anybody with a with an actual medical disease understands that.
Mm-hmm.
But with addiction, you can say, I'm not going to do this anymore. So loved ones need to understand that their addicts, the addicts they love so much, their loved ones, they, you know, people they remember from before they became addicted,
mm-hmm.
they're making choices here.
Mm-hmm.
They're not powerless, and they're going to try to tell you they're powerless so that they can stay doing this because they're scared to stop.
Right.
But they're not powerless, and they're not, you know, they don't have a disease. This isn't an actual disease. You know, people like to say it's a brain disease, and obviously there's brain involvement in addiction, but there's brain involvement in everything that we do. I know you can't see me, but I'm just moving my finger up and down, and right. there's brain involvement in me moving my finger up and down. So there's just brain involvement in everything. That doesn't make it a disease that we're powerless over. So your addict is, or alcoholic or whatever, gambler, gamer, sex addict, whatever, your addict is making the choice to stay there. And one of the reasons that they're making the choice to stay there often is because they're pretty comfortable there, especially if you, as the loved one, are enabling the addict. So I would like to give a definition of enabling if I can.
That would be great.
Okay. So enabling is when we do for somebody else what they can and actually should. Should is not a word I use very often, mm-hmm. but what they can and should be doing for themselves.
Okay.
When we do for them what they can and should be doing for themselves, we're enabling them. And helping, instead of enabling, is allowing them to figure things out by themselves, feeling the consequences of the choices that they're making, preparing them for the world that actually exists out there, instead of, you know, pampering them and thinking that they have no resilience of their own. And they do. They can make different choices. I did, they can. So this is what loved ones really need to know. And I so believe so deeply that when we stop the enabling, if we could just stop the enabling in the world, including society and how society enables addicts, addiction would stop dead in its tracks. But that's not what's happening. So my message is we need to stop enabling addicts. And the work that I do with families shows you how to do that. And I'll say one more thing. You know, often when clients come to me, I've been doing this work for 30 years, and many times loved ones come to me, and it's like the first thing out of their mouth is, "We know we're enabling, but
mm-hmm.
we know we're enabling, but." And the end of that sentence is, we don't know what else to do. And that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what else to do. Let us show you what else to do.
So
we can change all of this.
If we, you know, it's so fascinating because enabling comes from a place of love and not intention of harm, obviously. So when we think about, if we've got somebody who's listening right now, who is questioning if they are enabling a situation or not sure, like what would be the key signs that you're enabling somebody?
Well, I mentioned a couple of them. And then I'll name a couple of those. Yeah. And then I'm going to explain why people do this.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Okay.
Yeah.
So giving an addict money, somebody who's an active addiction mm-hmm. of some kind, even if it's overspending or doesn't have to be drugs and alcohol, could be anything that's really kind of ruining their lives. If you give that person money or support that person in that kind of way, especially with money and especially with substances, you know where that money's going.
Right.
You're going to shoot that money into their arm or right. put it up their nose. And you're enabling the addiction. Mm-hmm. When somebody says to you, I just need 20 bucks, Mom, you know, please give me 20 bucks. And you give them 20 bucks, you're basically helping them, assisting them. Let's use that word. Mm-hmm. You're assisting them to stay in active addiction.
Okay.
And most loved ones don't realize that. Another thing that happens often is when addicts are allowed to live in the family home, they've spent all their money, they can't pay rent, they have nothing, and they come back home and they live there. This could be a husband, a wife, an adult child, a brother, a sister, right? And they live there and they're allowed to sleep all day and be up all night using, drinking, gaming, doing whatever they're doing, not contribute financially at all to the household, eat all the food that's in the fridge, but not have to pay for any of it, not have to pay for hydro when they have their warm, cushy shower or they're lying in their cushy bed, you know? And so why should they change anything? That's the question. Why should they change anything?
Yeah, they're
too comfortable.
Yeah.
And if you love somebody with addiction, what you want is for them to stop doing the addiction.
Right.
So if you're going to assist them to stay in the addiction, that's not going to work too well for you. So addicts need to face the consequences of the choices that they're making so that they can make different choices. It's really kind of that simple. It's not easy, mm-hmm. but it's simple. It's not easy. But how easy is it to keep going the way you're going if you're living this kind of life with an addict? That's harder.
Well, I'm curious because, again, I'm sure we're going to have people that are listening that this is resonating with them.
Yep.
And so let's say, for example, teenager, gaming, and the parents are trying to put some, lay the law down, shall we say, and it's not going well. Or, I mean, consistency, I know I'm answering my own question. Consistency is king, obviously. But do you have some suggestions when it comes to, nobody wants to throw someone they love out on the street?
Nope.
So,
and that's not usually the first thing I suggest.
Of course not.
There's lots of things we can do before that.
Yeah. Do you have a couple things that people can start testing the water with to see if they get the response they're looking for? Like, what are some thoughts?
Okay. Well, I'm going to answer something else first, because I believe that it's imperative for the loved ones to understand why they have such a problem setting boundaries and maintaining those mm-hmm. boundaries. Because, they can set a boundary and the first time the addict they love says no or F off or whatever they say, they're going to back down.
Right.
Loved ones are often what we call people pleasers.
Mm-hmm.
The buzzword in the industry is codependent.
Mm-hmm.
And a codependent person, my simple definition for codependency, most people have heard that word now, is when we put other people's needs ahead of our own on a pretty consistent basis. That's codependency. And I like to call it people pleasing sometimes, because people pleasers are historically terrified of confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are any people pleasers listening, and there probably are, hello, I'm a recovering people pleaser, just so you know. you know what I'm saying is true. It's like,
amen.
I had that badge too.
Yep.
So it's like, I will do anything I need to do to not have conflict because I don't know how to handle the conflict. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to handle it. I don't know how to handle it when they get angry at me. I don't know how to handle it when they say, you're a rotten mother or you're a horrible sister or you're, you know, I don't know what to do with that. And I feel terrible. And so I don't want that to happen. So I'm going to say yes when I really mean no.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like the worst thing you can do with an addict because it hurts the addict. It harms your own self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
But it can really hurt the addict. It can be a question of life and death when we enable an addict.
Yes.
So the important thing is to be able to learn what's that about for you? Where did that start? How can we feel that? So that you can actually have the self-respect that is your birthright mm-hmm. and be able to say, no, this is not going to continue to happen. And you can say whatever you want to me. If you punch a hole in the wall or if you hurt me or anybody else in the family, you're out. But no, this is not happening anymore. So we need you to be up in the morning by 8. You need to be either looking for a job or being in a school program or being in a recovery program. And you might not be out of the house because of COVID, but you're online and you're doing something with your life and you're not sleeping all day and you're not keeping us awake all night. And no. No more of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what needs to happen. But for many loved ones, there are steps involved in getting to that place. That's what we work with you on. And it's totally understandable that you'd be a little nervous about this.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about, you know, I like to say that there are two kinds of pain. Pain is pain, but there are two kinds of pain. One kind of pain goes on and on and on and on and on. This could take me a while, on and on and on. The other kind of pain hurts,
mm-hmm.
but there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And you get to decide, every one of you that's listening today, we each get to decide which kind of pain we want in our lives. The other thing is that loved ones need to understand that when they set boundaries and maintain them and have consequences, this is not a punishment for the addict.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a punishment. This is a consequence, but it's not a punishment. We're doing this because we love you so much. It tears us apart to watch you be in your addiction like this. It terrifies us that you're going to die. We hate seeing you like this. We don't want you to live this life. That's how much we love you. This is why we're doing this.
And
when that message can be given, a lot of things can change and shift.
Do you find that if the family or the, you know, whoever the influence is in reference to that, the, you know, who owns the home or, you know, whether it's like you say, siblings, parents, loved ones,
mm-hmm.
do you find generally, and I know you shared this at the beginning, I'm assuming there's a spot where it gets worse before it gets better. And then
most times, yeah.
Yeah. Like,
and that's problematic because addiction can be life or death.
Right. Right.
And we want to stop loving addicts to death.
Right.
We want to stop loving addicts to death. We want to love addicts to life.
Mm, that's really beautifully said. Love addicts to life. And yeah. So here's the other thing. We have people in our lives, some social drink, some drink every day. Some do what you would deem social, you know, smoking marijuana, et cetera, et cetera. How do you know if you've got this experience in your life? Is there defining moments where you know it goes from social use to addiction? Like, are there some keys that people can look for?
Yeah, there are some cues, and I think people see them. They just don't want to.
Well, this is why I want to shed some light on these babies.
Yeah.
And, we know, but we don't want to know it.
It's so understandable that you don't want to know it. It's so understandable that you don't want to see this. But until you do see it in your loved one, until you're willing to take the blinders off, nothing much will change. One of my favorite sayings in the whole wide world, I wish I could take credit for it, but I didn't make it up, but I stole it. And it's that if nothing changes, nothing changes.
It's so true.
And the other way to say that is if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always gotten.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the signs, and it kind of, it can, some of them can be different depending on the age of the person.
Of course.
But, you know, if it's a kid in school, for example, their grades are going down. They're not spending time on the schoolwork. They're skipping school. There's just a lot of school trouble, usually. And again, you know, COVID has changed some of this because people aren't as free to kind of roam around as they used to be. Maybe that's coming back at some point, but we're not talking about that, so I won't go into that. But they start choosing different kinds of friends to hang out with. Adults are more often isolative.
Okay.
They will go out and party. It depends on what the addiction is. You know, sometimes they will go out and party with people. Party is a word that I, you know, because there comes a point where it's not a party anymore. It's a need.
Mm-hmm.
It's an absolute need. And when addiction goes past the point of partying into need, it is no longer fun at all.
Right.
So, you know, they might go to the bar and hang out and be, you know, raucous with their friends. But many addicts and alcoholics use isolatively. They isolate and they drink and they use and they game for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And they, you know, or they go to the mall and they shop and they bring home all kinds of stuff and they start hoarding. And there's just a whole lot of things that can happen. But patterns change, habits change, friends seem to change, mood swings. You know, you try to get a gamer to come up to dinner. That's not a lot of fun to try to do.
Oh my gosh.
And when an overspender doesn't have money for the rent, or a gambler doesn't have money for the rent, they need you to pay their rent. If you say no, that's not going to be very pleasant.
Right.
But if you don't deal with that, they're going to be 65 years old, still living in your house when you're 90.
Right. And you'll still be paying their expenses and bills. And
if they're still alive.
Right.
You know, if addiction hasn't gotten them, you know,
right.
And I've known families who, you know, they've lost their addicts, and, you know, the enabling didn't stop soon enough, and they've lost their addicts, and the line is, how could this have happened?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we kind of know how it happens. We want to stop it. We want to prevent it from happening. We need education, prevention, and treatment about enabling, not just about addiction, but about enabling addiction, because that's the flip side of the coin. And it's what keeps it going.
You know, I've got this question for you, and I would guess there are people listening. It just, we have a lot of young people struggling right now. And
we do. Yep.
When does it become, because this is the thing, they hit a certain age. It's like, okay, you're on your own. I'm not doing this anymore. The fear of doing that, and the parent seeing their kid on the news, or, you know, getting the call from the police, I think that holds them hostage in that enabling phase.
Yeah.
Do you have any,
it does.
Yeah. I any have, suggestions I, or advice around that?
Yeah. I have a family that I'm working with right now with a 20-year-old son. They've just been going through this, and the son has moved out, and he actually I work with him as well, because we work with the addicts as well as the family. And he's actually not using right now, which is great. He stopped using.
That's amazing.
I hope he continues, you know.
Yeah, of course.
I'm sorry, I kind of lost the gist of your question. Can you ask me again, please?
So let's, you know, we've got a parent with an 18-year-old at home that has to move out for survival. Right.
Okay.
Like to keep the family unit from imploding and how do we enable past that?
Yeah. It's very difficult. This is not, it's not easy to kick somebody out of your house that you love and you're worried about. And you're scared might die out there. And this is really a difficult thing. One thing to know is that if enabling doesn't stop, your addict can die in your home too.
That's a good point.
They can overdose there.
Yeah.
They can kill themselves there. Because, see, when addicts are using like that, and this is similar to what happened to me, it was a little different, but similar. On paper, enabled addicts seem to have it made. They get their meals cooked and their laundry done and they don't have to do anything and they can be obnoxious and they can have their friends over till, you know, 3 a.m. and they seem to have it made. But we know what we're doing. I can guarantee you that. We know what we're doing. We understand the choice we're making. And we look around at other people our age or, you know, we see that other people have different lives. They're married with families. They've got jobs. They're, you know, they've got a nice car. They're right. And we know that's not us. And it's at that point when an addict can really admit that to himself. And that doesn't happen when they're continually enabled.
Right.
But when an addict can say to themselves, oh, I don't like this life. I don't like this life. I want a different life. That's when change can be made. So
I'm hearing that is basically if you truly love the person that you are with, whatever that is, whether it's by blood, whether it's by choice, when you enable them, you're hurting them. Whereas if you stand firm, no matter what the wrath, you're actually showing them that you love them unconditional.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly right. I couldn't have put it better. Enabling is never a loving act with an addict.
Okay.
Because it keeps them stuck in whatever addiction or addictions they're stuck in. It just keeps them stuck there. And how can it be a loving act to keep an addict stuck? So the loved ones who love their addict so much, you know, need to understand why they're doing this and how they can stop doing this. And once that happens, all kinds of changes happen in the family. Families heal. Everybody's affected and everybody needs to heal. And that's what we do at Love with Boundaries. That's what we do.
I can't thank you enough, Candace, for being on the show today, for sharing this wisdom. It's not an easy topic for people. It's, you know, it's not a lighthearted topic, but it's an important topic because we are all touched by, you know, as you're sharing your stories, I'm thinking of all the people I know that need to listen to this episode, and myself included, as a mom in setting boundaries that are healthy for my children and staying firm in those boundaries. You know, it might not be addiction related, but there's still boundaries, right? And loving through action. And I can't thank you enough for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Can I say two more things?
Please. Yes.
Okay. Maybe even three. One is that when you walk down the street or you're in a coffee shop or someplace out in public, even though we're not wearing signs on our foreheads that say, I'm affected by somebody else's addiction, pretty much 99.999 of the people that you see are either affected by somebody else's addiction or know somebody who's affected by somebody else's addiction. That's how rampant it is. And so many loved ones don't talk about this because they're so ashamed. They think they're the only ones and nobody's going to understand me. We understand you. we understand what's going on for you and we know you need help and we can give you that help. That's why we're here. It's our bliss to do that. So know that you're not alone. If you don't want to be, you're not alone. The second thing is, please never give up. Never give up. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle happens, as that saying goes. Keep going, keep trying. And I want to let people know that at Love with Boundaries, that's my company, Love with Boundaries, we offer, and we're at lovewithboundaries.com, we offer a free 30-minute consultation.
Amazing.
Where you can tell us what's going on for you. We'll tell you how we can help you. We'll see if we're a fit. You know, it's no obligation, no money, nothing. You just tell us if you need help. And what you need to do is fill out a questionnaire. And if you go to lovewithboundaries.com, you'll see that questionnaire. It's right there on the homepage. And just fill it out and submit it. And we're going to get back to you right away because we know that addiction does not wait.
I love it. And, you know, everybody that's listening, if you're walking right now or driving your car, don't panic. We're going to put all of Candace's contact information into the show notes.
Yeah,
so do not worry, you will be able to find her.
Yeah.
We want to make sure that you have, and that is a generous offer. So any of you that are feeling that you might need support or you're not sure if you do need support, take Candace up on that free offer and connect with her.
Yep.
Because it could change your life.
It could change your life. It could change your addict's life. It could keep your addict alive.
Yeah. It's a powerful
thing. Keep them out of jail.
Right? All the things. Oh my God.
All those things.
Thank you so much, Candace, from the bottom of my heart and for all our listeners for being here. I appreciate you sharing not only your vulnerability and your own story, but those beautiful suggestions to help people move through this, you know, tragic and changeable situation that people are in.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity to be able to do that. And if you're listening today, we're here. We're here for you.
Awesome. And thank you so much for listening, everyone. I appreciate you being here. We hope this has ignited some type of movement in your lives, whether it's to reach out to a friend that you see that might be suffering as somebody that is supporting an addict, or two, that you might be as well, somebody that's in that codependency situation. Do not hesitate to reach out. You are not alone. We invite you to obviously come and check us out at Your Holistic Earth, and we encourage you to ignite the wellness warrior in you. Thanks so much for listening.
Fantastic. Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Winning with Wellness. If something you heard today sparked your interest or fired up your curiosity, please head over to Apple Podcasts now, hit subscribe, and leave us a review. Your review helps us ignite the wellness warriors in others. Your community is waiting for you. Don't forget to activate your free wellness membership to Your Holistic Earth. You'll find the link in the show notes. It is never too late to redefine your wellness, and you don't have to do it alone. One small action can lead to life-changing results. I know because it did for me. And from my heart to yours, thank you for sharing your most valuable asset with me, you.